Okay, we're back. Now, you were talking about Andrew Hastie and the position he's in. It's interesting that he not only came out in support of increased taxes on gas exporters and so on, but he's more critical of Donald Trump than certainly his own party, but more critical than the Albanese government. He is starting to criticise the prosecution of the war. He has had a go at Trump personally on one or two things. He's getting himself in a really interesting position on that and on taxation. You look at the way that the last election campaign was prosecuted, and Peter Dutton took a big hit because he was perceived to be too close to Donald Trump, not just in rhetoric but on some policy fronts. I don't think Andrew Hastie would fall for that. But you watch Question Time through the week, and it's all about, I think, a rather futile exercise in a way with the coalition trying to hit the government over the fact that we have a shortage of fuel and we're paying more for it, when I think people understand why that is the case. And unless they've got better ideas about how to manage it, then, you know, just get in there and help. I just think that it points up the fact that I know that it was always going to be a bridge too far for the coalition to oppose the war. But think about if they had, where they would have the government right now, that you supported this thing. Mm. And now look at the consequences. Don't you ever think through the consequences and whatever? And I could see Andrew Hastie managing an attack like that. But that's kind of a hypothetical thing that's not going to happen, because both major parties in Australia, and with the exception of Simon Crean all those years ago, that just seems to be the way that they are with America, no matter how far they stretch it.
And Andrew Hastie, whilst he's only been there for just over 6 years, he was elected in a by-election. Sorry, he was elected in a by-election in 2015. But in 2019, him and Jim Molan came out. They were committee members on an inquiry, and they talked about fuel reserves and the importance of increasing it from 30 days to 90 days. So this self-sufficiency message is not a new thing that he's been doing, which works in his favour, because it's not seen as a tactical response. It's seen as a values-driven position. What we're going to see as this crisis unfolds, and Trump, of course, is all over the shop, but I don't see it finishing in the next week. If the fuel reserves becomes really critical in Australia, and I think it's down to 24 days was the last report I saw, then we're going to see the sort of mood sentiment that we saw with the Pfizer vaccine rollout, where there was supply chain issues there, and the Morrison government was blamed for not being, well, Greg Hunt in particular as health minister was blamed for not purchasing the required vaccines as quickly as possible.
And that was, I think, reasonable at the time.
Yeah.
It was demonstrated that they hadn't, whereas this would be a different situation where the whole world would be facing a shortage, and I don't think anybody's out there getting the break on us and buying petrol that is available to us if we just get our act together.
Yeah, but then you come back to the argument of reserves and why has it been at 30 days. Now, Bill Shorten, to his credit, in 2019, a part of his campaign policy was to increase it to 90 days. That was going to cost Australian taxpayers effectively between $10 and $20 billion was the costings. Morrison decided not to make it bipartisan, because that was going to affect his costings, and he'd rather spend that, say, $15 billion on other electorate incentives. So you had Molan, Hastie, AWU, Bill Shorten advocating for this, and unfortunately for Australia, we didn't go down that path.
The focus on Question Time is about, it's almost all that. It does have the feeling at times, though, that it's like somebody complaining about the weather and blaming the government, or you're sitting in traffic and you're blaming the traffic when you are the traffic, you know.
Yeah.
And then there was this, the government comes up with suggestions, and they're putting together a national approach. What they want to do is bring all the states in so that whatever they do with a national focus and not just go down their own path. And yet I'm listening to a debate on commercial radio, and the host was really getting stuck into the government, because now they want the taxpayer to do the heavy lifting. You know, this idea of the soft approach that you can take, that is, take public transport. Don't drive unless you absolutely have to. Carpooling, these sorts of things just make sense. It's not asking a lot of people. It's just saying, if you want to extend this thing out a bit and preserve some fuel, this is one way to go about it. But that then is thrown back at them saying, no, don't ask the taxpayer to solve your problems. You know, you fix them. it is a problem that everybody has to focus on. And I think that's going to have to be part of the national approach. And when they say national, it's most of the governments are Labor, so they'll, you know, get along reasonably well on that. We'll just see how Queensland goes with it.
But I think it will hurt Albanese in the medium term. I think it plays straight into the hands of One Nation. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw another small increase for One Nation in terms of vote share. You're right. Like, the problem for the coalition as opposition is voters will say, well, hang on a sec, why didn't you fix it? You were in government just recently. And, of course, with the exception of a few noted figures, as we said before, the policy was bipartisan. And so it makes it very hard to then attack them, which, as you said, you know, voters will just say, well, hang on a sec, you know, you're part of the problem, mate. Yeah. Whereas One Nation and their message around self-sufficiency will be the beneficiary, I think.
But there's another wider debate to have around the self-sufficiency angle, like the arguments that some put up against renewable energy, electric cars and so on. Reliability and price, what we're now seeing is with fossil fuels, look at reliability and look at price. Mm. And so it's an opportunity, isn't it, for the government now to go harder on renewable energies and use the experience of this war and the way that it's impacted around the world to try and persuade people to come on board.
I think it's going to be a fascinating debate to watch because it could go either way at the moment. And again, it depends on exactly what happens over the coming weeks and months. Hopefully there's a resolution very quickly and that supplies are restored to near levels where they were prior. But if they're not, you could also see a return to people wanting more fossil fuel solutions here in Australia rather than relying on renewable energy. But it could go the other way as well. It's going to require on not just the circumstances but the way how these cases are prosecuted. Obviously, you've got big influential figures out there arguing for a return to more fossil fuel load-based energy, and then you've got others sort of trying to dial up the importance of EVs, for example. The problem is, of course, in Australia, we've got around 500,000 fixed-axle diesel trucks, you know, for delivery of goods, 100,000 semi-trailers and 100,000 buses. That doesn't even include tradies' utes, which are diesel-operated and so forth. You know, the economy runs on diesel. And, you know, even if you could, by, you know, a stroke of a pen, everybody could afford to swap over to an electric vehicle tomorrow and simply write off their petrol-fueled car, Australia doesn't have the grid capacity for electricity to actually recharge all your electric cars. So, yeah, the transition to renewable energy is probably one of the biggest, most gargantuan policy areas I've ever been involved in. And I'd probably do about 2 days a week work in the renewable energy sector. There is no easy solutions to any of this at the moment.
I think Australia, pound for pound, is the most diesel-dependent economy in the world. Mm. And we're learning that lesson right now. Can I just throw back one email to you, going back to the One Nation issue, and it's from Annal from South Australia. And he can understand first preference votes for One Nation. It's a protest vote, or it might be more than that. But however, how do you explain why some would place One Nation second? Like, is there a profile of people who vote Labor 1 and One Nation second, Liberal 1, One Nation second? And with the Liberals, that means their preferences matter, right, in that sense. But there surely is, and we'll see that from this election, that voting Liberal 1 and One Nation 2 wouldn't be that unusual. They're people who don't want the Labor Party at any price.
Yeah. What I have found over the years, and I remember during the Howard government, I was working at Crosby Texter with the great Mark Texter, one of the most brilliant pollsters, and we did a series of focus groups in Sydney based on preferences because in New South Wales they have optional preferential, which makes it even more problematic for the other parties because you can just simply vote one nation and then put the ballot in the box and walk away. And that's a big risk to parties like the coalition that might be hoping for a second preference and One Nation to be eliminated first. So the preferences are distributed to them, which at the moment on our polling is 69% will go to them and 31% will go to Labor. The big risk has always been is that people just don't understand preference voting by and large. Most voters don't understand how it operates. And we did two-hour focus groups trying to explore this and trying to explain it. So it was uncontested. It was just simply trying to explain to people why distributing preferences is important to get the result that you want to get. And I can tell you, I do recall I was about an hour through. Tex was behind the mirror watching, and there was a very loud, angry knock on the door every 15 minutes because of he thought I was being incompetent because they simply weren't understanding how it worked. And in the end, he, which was very rare for him because he's quite private, in the end, he actually sort of jumped in the focus group and started talking to them, and even he couldn't land it. So to successfully communicate that is very difficult. And when you want voters to focus on the core issues about cost of living and your plan for a cost of living to make their lives better, you know, do you really want to take up the bandwidth of that communication platform by talking about preferences?
Yeah, it has to be explained to them. Already in social media, you get the blowback from South Australia from One Nation people who say, we got 22% of the vote. We deserve 22% of the seats.
Yeah.
Right? They think it's that simple. It's not just understanding the preference system. It's understanding the fact that elections are a whole amalgamation of seats, and you get to vote individually in every seat. And if only 22% of people in that seat want a One Nation representative, you're not going to get a seat.
Yeah.
And that's got to be understood. And it's, if they want a system different to that, where you don't have a representative representing a certain area, then tell us what the alternative is. But that's the part that has to be understood. It's not the Senate. It's not the Senate. It's the House of Representatives. And 22%, if you're not getting preferences, if that's all you're getting, it won't cut it. Well, that's it for today. We're taking a break next week for Easter, but we'll be back as usual the following week, Saturday, April 11. This podcast was made on the sovereign lands of the Wurundjeri people. It was produced by Daniel Simo, video production Bird Nguyen.
Executive producer is Hannah Parks.
I'm Barry Cassidy.
And I'm Tony Barry. And this is Back to Back Barry's A Guardian Australia podcast.